Hello, my name is Chris Gondak, class of 1990. This interview with Josh Picot, class of 24, about his thesis on the history of WCFM was originally recorded on the 17th of March, 2024, for the 2024 WCFM Throwback Weekend. Unfortunately, there was a disk error with the archiving system, so the original interview does not exist. However, we were able to re-record this interview on April 2nd, 2024. If you have any questions about the WCFM Throwback, you can always reach me at admin@wcfmthrowback.com. Or if you have any requests or dedications for next year's throwback, you can email me at requests@wcfmthrowback.com. Hope you enjoy this interview. Josh Picot, thanks so much for taking time to do this interview today.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here. It's been quite the journey to over the past year with WCFM material, so I'm happy I get to talk to you about it.
For the historical record, let's go in a little bit about your history before we start getting WCFM. Where are you from?
I am from Simsbury, Connecticut, born and raised there, 2 hours south of Williamstown, and I am class of 2024 at Williams. I'm a history major, and I am currently writing my senior thesis on the history of WCFM 91.9 Williamstown, our campus radio station.
Why'd you choose Williams?
Well, you know, I could give you the pretty answer about how it was the small class sizes and the tutorial format, which were all a factor. But I remember when I was touring in 2019, it was the Chapin Library's signed copy of the Federalist Papers by George Washington. And I don't know why that stuck with me more than anything else on a tour, but I said, you know, I gotta be there to see that. And now I work in special collections, so mission accomplished.
That was the one that we made sure they did not take the Amherst back in 1821.
Right, exactly.
Where did your connection to college radio, your interest in college radio, come from?
I knew I wanted to do college radio when I came to college pretty early, because kind of the way I got into music as a kid was through this box of cassette tapes in our basement of all my dad's college radio shows when he was at WPRB at Princeton. And so I grew up listening to his midnight mini concert, you know, 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. slot, and he'd play classic rock. And that was my first exposure to what student broadcasting was like, and I thought it was the coolest thing, and that stuck with me up to now. I still think it's, you know, it's magic.
Has your dad heard your show?
He has. I mean, he pretty regularly tunes in. At least that's what he tells me. And, you know, he's coming to campus when I graduate in June, and we're going to, you know, do a kind of a father-son last show, which I'm looking forward to. So if you're listening, Dad, hope you really do tune in. You might just be my only listener.
Let's talk about the thesis. When did you decide your thesis was going to be on the history of WCFM?
I was pretty confident I wanted to write something about my radio station as soon as I joined. I joined as a sophomore Friday night DJ. Station was closed all of my freshman year from coronavirus, regrettably. But when I joined sophomore year, I immediately encountered just how much stuff is stored in the halls of WCFM, and I imagine college radio generally. It's decades of old show posters, zines, program guides, all this stuff. And in addition, as I learned through my thesis research, decades of correspondence between DJs and the federal government, the administration, and record labels. And, you know, this stuff just sits around you when you do your radio show. It doesn't look like it's moved anywhere in years, and few people pay attention to it. But I thought there must be something here, you know, an untapped archive of student engagement at Williams Radio spanning almost 80 years, and I wanted to interrogate it further. So that's why I chose to write about it.
What was the reaction of your faculty advisor when you told him or her, I want to do the history of WCFM?
I was actually rejected from my first proposal for the thesis was not approved. They said, how can you write, you know, a year-long senior thesis on your college radio station? It sounds absurd. You know, what is your primary source base? What's your argument? And, you know, I internalized a lot of that. I was like, well, you know, I actually don't know here. I mean, it's pretty tough because a lot of the documents you encounter at a college radio station are not ones that are traditionally archivable. It's these reel-to-reel tapes, or it's these crumpled pieces of paper that might have some chicken scratch on it that a DJ wrote 40 years ago. None of this stuff makes it into the college archives, and it's not something you can look up in a database or a subject file. So rightfully, I think the history department was skeptical. They said, you know, this is not a traditional thesis, nor is it a traditional archive you're looking at. But, you know, second time around, I said, you know, just give me a chance. And a year later, hopefully I've convinced a few more. We'll see at my thesis defense at the end of the month. But, it was tough seeing it through in the beginning, getting people on board.
So I guess as far as documents, I know the college archive had some WCFM material. I mean, I sent you some stuff about their recordings, but I guess, are you saying that there was the archive material that the Williams College had in the library and the archival system, and then a whole other set of materials that had just been around the station that never actually had got into an official archive?
Yeah, I'm glad you bring this up. There is material in our college archives about WCFM. It's a lot of photos that we, I think, got from the Williams Record, our student newspaper. And some, really boxes of these uncatalogued voice recordings, mainly from the 60s and 70s of DJs. And Chris, you did send me a finding aid for that material, which, the people working at Special Collections didn't know they had. This is material that was sitting in their offsite storage that never was never formally cataloged. It's not in the online database. And it was actually only through that finding aid, that the reintroduction of that finding aid, that material was rediscovered. And I've now spent some time digitizing and archiving that material formally. But yes, there's a whole separate archive that exists in our radio station, completely maintained, however haphazardly, by the students. A lot of things that maybe our college archives wouldn't consider necessarily archivable material, like I said, you know, the loose pieces of paper with some writing on it. Those have, for some reason, stuck around in our station and have been preserved, I think, really through neglect, in a way.
And it's amazing, because you think that the station has gone through, from what I can tell, really three locations, starting in LaSalle and then long time in Baxter and now in Prospect House, that still those documents moved from point A to point B, to point C, I guess.
It's pretty incredible. I mean, I've say this a bit in my writing, in the thesis, but you know, college radio stations have an institutional memory problem. There's a super high turnover rate in these clubs because students are always graduating, and because of that, you know, I'm a product of this as the general manager of the station currently. The new boards might not really know what's going on. They got to relearn a lot of this stuff about the station. Who are the right people to talk to? How do you get on air? How do you, fix the transmitter when it breaks? It seems like WCFM rediscovers itself every 4 years. And because of that, it's easy to lose sight of some of this material that follows you along the way. So it is pretty remarkable that it's stuck around. And, you know, I applaud whoever, kept that material. It's what has made this thesis.
So let's get into the history. Why did the college start the station in the first place?
I wouldn't use the word the college because it was not the college's idea. It started in 1940 through the dormitory in Sage Hall, the freshman dormitory, by one freshman, Alan Urich. He was a ham radio operator in his youth. He actually circumnavigated the world on Captain Irving Johnson's schooner called Yankee the year before he came to Williams, and was the radio operator on that boat. So he knew a bit about how radios worked, and he wanted to start a station of his own at the college, which at first had to operate pretty, it was a clandestine operation. He got a couple students involved who also knew a lot about the technical construction of radio and radio sets, and they would string wires underground in the steam tunnels and across the roofs of dormitories to connect the campus buildings to this wired radio signal. And the reason they did this is because they weren't eligible for a wireless FCC license to broadcast an AM frequency on the air. So they resorted to this thing called carrier current, which was this wired AM system built into the college campus that only students could hear. So it wasn't actually the college that knew about the radio station at all when it started. It was a fully student effort that kind of took off in secret.
So it's funny you mentioned Al Urich, because when we were there for the throwback this year and you had all the materials, I went right away to the, probably to my mind, one of the most interesting documents there, the Variety story from January 22nd, 1941, when Variety came out to Williams, because I used Williams as an example of the burgeoning college broadcasting, movement at that time. And that article was interesting for a lot of ways. First of all, probably the first time WMS was ever mentioned, but they talked about Al Urich as the design person, but they said that George Goldberg was, quote unquote, the founder of the station. So what was George Goldberg's relationship to the station? I guess, who was George Goldberg?
It was George Goldberg and Paul Rochelle who worked with the editor of the Williams Record, Scudder Parker. They were some of the first co-presidents of WMS, which was the carrier current name of the radio station, which is now called WCFM. So Goldberg was technically the president, one of the first presidents of WMS. And Allen was never president. He always called himself the chief engineer, or was sometimes referred to as the mole, because he would be the one to go underground. That Variety article, I'm glad you brought that up. It's called College Boy Fun Stations Actually Draw National Advertising Attention. And I think it's hilarious. I mean, this was the attitude at the time toward people like Goldberg or Urich or Rochelle. Or Parker, these were guys who were destined for failure. I mean, amateurs, students, building a radio station of their own on campus without an FCC license. How is that ever going to last? They had very little money. The university wasn't funding them. They called it a fledgling enterprise, and it took off. They, like the article says, they were able to draw national advertisers to their station. Goldberg was very involved in this. So they would do Lucky Strike commercials for cigarettes. They had a spot for the Biltmore Hotel. And so you have this really interesting dynamic develop where you have this student-oriented station that sounds like a commercial frequency. It's running advertisements because since you're not technically on the air as a wireless educational station, you're allowed to run ads. You don't have to be non-commercial or non-profit. Goldberg was instrumental in that.
And I should point out, as I learned from the article, or maybe my own research, that George Goldberg was in fact the son of Rube Goldberg, the cartoonist. And when I mentioned this to another former DJ, his response is, well, that explains the transmitter. In our first time we did this, because for people listening, this is a redo. We had an archiving issue with the first interview, but you'd mentioned that there was, during the wiring of the carrier current, there was an issue with Hopkins Hall.
That's correct. Hopkins Hall, where most of our administrative offices are now on Williams campus, was a particularly hard place to reach at the time this carrier current was being expanded across campus. The steam pipe tunnels where the wires were being laid narrowed significantly around Hopkins Hall. And the student's solution to this at WMS was to fashion their own makeshift bow and arrow. And they would tie the radio wire around the tip of the arrow and shoot it through the tunnel to the other side. And there's this one story from 1941 where a student pulls the bowstring a little too far back. The arrow goes flying through the wall on the other side of the tunnel, straight into a woman's bathroom in Hopkins Hall, and these students had to sheepishly walk into the administrative building and go and retrieve their radio wire. This is just one example of the very amateur way the station took off, which I think the Variety article that you mentioned appropriately brings attention to. There was no question it was a student operation.
So you mentioned that it was a student operation, and I got a sense that perhaps the college knew about it, maybe a wink and a nod, as far as they were, it was not officially sanctioned by the college. When did the college, I guess, officially welcome WMS and then finally WCFM into the official bosom of the college?
It was pretty early on. I don't think the station existed for more than a year before the administration got wind of it. It was a little hard to hide the fact that you were digging up, breaking ground on campus to lay some of this wire. But the administration pretty quickly supported the station. Williams College was by no means the first college radio station. And on other campuses where stations had succeeded, the universities marketed them as these public learning tools where students could tape lecture series and put them on air for students or community members to hear. Or they were pre-professional settings where students could come and learn how to be a broadcaster before they went on to take on a career in broadcasting. So early on, WMS as amateur as its construction and expansion was, the college saw it as a good opportunity to teach students about this still relatively new radio medium.
Formats back then. I mean, nowadays, if you turn on WCFM or tune in either in Williamstown at 91.9 or listen online, it's pretty much, I would say, a pretty big selection of popular music and or maybe not so popular music, but definitely it's a music focus. Was that the way it's always been? And I mean, can you talk about the early years as far as like what would one hear on WCFM, say in either the 50s or 60s?
That's a great question. WCFM today is in some ways exactly the same as it was in 1940, but in many ways, including the music that's played, very different. But in the 50s and 60s, WCFM had just gone live for the first time. WMS had graduated to its first FM antenna. It had received an actual license from the FCC to broadcast at 10 watts, something called a Class D license. And for the first time, 1957, WCFM goes live. It's a public radio station. And in my research, what I've seen is as much as DJs love playing this, you know, newfangled rock and roll, and classical and jazz music, there was this large component of news programs and public affairs programs that seemed to take over the station in the 60s, which would typically be referenced as the height of freeform radio. The hippie movement. You have people playing album-oriented rocks, these deep cuts, these, nearly hourly spins of Stairway to Heaven in the 70s and 12-minute guitar solos. And that was all there. But you also had this very professional-sounding news broadcasts that went on at WCFM at the same time. And so it was the station, public radio station, that students realized needed to be both a community service but also something that satisfied student interests and their likes and dislikes in terms of what music they wanted to play. So there's a tension there between what the station wanted to be when it went public.
Let's talk about the 1960s, because obviously it was a very challenging time all over the country. And WCFM during that, Williams College in that decade, had some of its biggest controversies. The elimination of fraternities in 1962, all of the anti-war and Civil War protests that were going on during the late 60s, early 70s, the beginning of co-education in the late 60s, early 70s. Is there a particular area in which WCFM really stood out dealing with these controversies?
The strikes in 1970, the student strikes, were very well documented at WCFM. I mentioned its emphasis on news. You got to remember, you're in the remote northern Berkshires. A lot of students at the time got their news from the student newspaper, which was published weekly, and WCFM, which had news programs daily. So back then, people turned to our campus radio station on campus and in Williamstown where our signal would reach, for news updates. There was this expectation that WCFM would be on top of not just what was happening locally, but also national news coverage. So this is where you get a lot of pictures in our station archives of WCFM DJs, not at the mic, but at a typewriter, writing news reports for that document the student strikes at Williams, but also at other liberal arts colleges in the area. And they would, rip it off the typewriter or rip it off the United Press International teletype that we had at the time, go to the mic and deliver a report. And there was a solid week during those strikes where barely any music programming was played. It was just minute-by-minute reports about what was happening nationally, which is very different, like you said, to how WCFM operates today. There was certainly this expectation that WCFM would be tuned in to these national happenings.
Now, I know in your research you spoke to a lot of former DJs. You spoke to me. You spoke to, just because I'm here, I was like, I'll pick myself an example. But were you able to talk to DJs from that period, from like the late 60s, early 70s, who were there dealing with the general strike? And did they have any reminiscences?
I was. They said the documentation of it was called the Williams Strike Central club that organized the walkouts and the strikes that year. And they remember being a part of that. I spoke to a number of DJs who wrote the material that would be read on air. Until recently, all of that material was in the station where I found the rest of my research. But another student actually beat me to it and wrote a thesis about the Williams strikes and incorporated those WCFM documents into the special collections. So it's not just alumni who were there to account for this. It was also other students more recently who've researched this, which I thought was pretty interesting.
That is interesting. We need to talk about perhaps some internal controversies. Obviously, the things we talked about were mentioned, the fraternities, the general strike, the coeducation, that was campus-wide. Were there any particular controversies that were kind of more inside baseball that dealt with the station directly that the outside world might not have known about?
Chris, you might have been actually a student when this happened, but from time to time, I think when Becky Bond was general manager, so there would be some internal controversies about shows that would be allowed to go on air, the question of free speech, and if certain shows fit the bill to speak on air, because of course everyone was worried about in the late 80s and early 90s these the seven words you can never say on air, and there were a number of shows at the time that got canceled or taken off air because management said, we don't want to lose our signal. We don't want to lose our license. And that was a real fear, particularly among some of the DJs I spoke to in the mid-90s. But I would also bring it back to these larger themes of the tensions that existed in the station across all periods that weren't really noticeable on air. Just how students defined their roles on air and saw their purpose in being an announcer on the radio varied year to year, but also in a single year between DJs. Some approached the mic thinking that it was just a fun hour or two that they could spend playing music for their friends, or sometimes it was an entirely personal, creative pursuit where they didn't think anyone was listening at all, and they would just go and they'd spin some records, and that would be it. And other people, especially management, treated the station as this public affairs link between campus and the community. And you kind of see these students butt heads at some points when certain programming choices go against maybe the students' wishes in favor of community interests, and also vice versa, particularly in the 80s and 90s when WCFM becomes more alternative or starts playing more music from indie labels. And you get some angry letters from the town saying, what happened to my classical music programming that I listened to every night for the last 20 years? So there was this, I think, pretty constant tension between what students wanted WCFM to be. And that's not something you typically see in what goes out on air.
Where does your thesis end?
My thesis runs from 1940, when WMS was created, to 1998. I don't go into the 21st century, because 1998 was the first year WCFM turned on their internet stream, their real audio internet stream. It was also the first year, I believe, second year, that we had computers in the station, and our playlists and programming logs were now digital. And from some of the DJs I spoke to who were at the station during that moment of transition, all of them across the board said, you know, it was so amazing. I could do my show and my parents could tune in from California, or my boyfriend who was studying abroad could listen to my show from Spain. And I chose to stop my thesis here because I think the remoteness and the question of a local audience has been central to what defined WCFM in the 20th century. To whom was WCFM broadcasting? And once we get into the age of the internet, so many of those questions change or become unanswerable. Anyone could tune into WCFM all of a sudden. Its voice was infinitely expansive. After years of trying and fundraising for maybe 50 more watts in a transmitter, now all of a sudden you can reach people in Europe. And I, you know, there's a good almost 30 years now of information on how WCFM has navigated the internet age and what radio online looks like. But those are such big questions. I felt it couldn't fit in this thesis and is definitely worthy of more research.
So I guess if somebody's listening to this interview, say in 2074, 50 years from now, that may be where you suggest they would start.
Yeah, and I'd say come find me on the internet, and if that's still around, and come interview me.
Since we did this interview the first time, you did a panel interview actually right after our interview, where some of the DJs who were there for the throwback, you sat down with them and talked with them. Why did you want to do that?
First of all, to finally get some use out of that talk studio, which I don't think has been touched in 20 years, in our Prospect House station where we are now. But also because I think there's something very special about how going on air can give you a voice in a context you couldn't previously speak. You know, this is what I consider the magic of our antenna, that I can go on air and I don't really know who I'm speaking to. And I think it was great to bring those guys on and introduce their voices, reintroduce their voices to the community, and get to answer some questions together just about what their experiences were like. You know, in the interviews I do for the thesis, they're all one-on-one. And it was only during this conversation that I got to hear these voices, speak in tandem and in response to each other, which, of course, added something to the conversation that, say you or I couldn't get just in our solo interview.
What'd you learn from that panel?
Well, I learned that WCFM, a lot of things stay the same. There is always a question about what can be played on air. Are students doing the right thing? I recall Scott Figgins, who was external music director during his tenure at WCFM in the early 90s. I recall his remarks about contacting record labels and making piles of music in heavy and medium rotation to send to College Music Journal, which reported weekly playlists of top songs on college radio stations. And that's not something we do anymore. But the question of what music do we play and how are DJs selecting this music is still something we think about. I mean, you were in the room for this conversation. Did you have any takeaways that I'm forgetting here?
You know, I was in the room, but very briefly, and there was a reason for that. You put me in this. I was in the studio with you, and all those four guys were in the talk studio, and I had an interview coming up right after you, and I knew my guest was going to be in the green room, and because I think when you asked to do introductions. Yeah, although I've had a lot to do with WCFM after graduation, during my student time, I did a show, and I was friends with people that were very much, actually a lot of roommates that were very much into WCFM, and I was just concerned that I wasn't going to, well, one, I was concerned I wasn't going to be able to add anything to the conversation. And two, I've known these guys for 35 years. I thought, trust me, you're going to get more than enough information out of them. You don't need one more cook in the kitchen. But so to that, I can't really answer, but that leads to the question that's just been kind of, when I thought about this, like, this is what I personally would really want to know. You've written about the history of the station from 1940 to 1998. A large chunk of that, at least kind of in Bull's memories, might have been, and I'm using this term semi-ironically, the heyday of college radio, which had been the 80s through the 90s. You've listened to the station personally now from 2020 until 2024. You brought us back, and I can tell you what you heard that weekend of January 6th, March 16th and 17th was pretty much what the station sounded like in 1990. What'd you think of it? Was it strange to you to write about this stuff, and then all of a sudden, one weekend, there these people are doing WCFM?
Well, it's the scenario every historian and no historian wants to be in, where they, you know, that you finally get to speak to your sources. But also, oh my God, I finally get to speak to my sources. What if I got it all wrong? Thankfully, the discussions we had that weekend, I think, largely corroborated the traces that you and those DJs had left behind. Though I would say the sound, like you say, that came on air for that weekend is different than what WCFM sounds like now. And it's also different from what WCFM sounded like in 1970, 1957, or when Al Urich broadcast from Sage Hall with his jazz records. This is something that I think is great about college radio is, I should say WCFM specifically. We've always committed ourselves to being a completely freeform station as much as we can. And people get to choose whatever they like to bring to the mic. And so when you're looking at these program guides that span generations, you get to see this evolution in musical taste. And I think it's a quite authentic picture of what students wanted to hear and what they wanted to present to other people, whoever they defined as their audience. And I think that's really special.
So, Josh, we're recording this on the 2nd of April, 2024. When is your thesis finalized? When does it go in?
April 16th is the due date. So pray for me.
What's the thesis called?
The tentative title is Gas Pipes, Gigahertz, and Grunge, Radio Imaginations at Williams College. Gas Pipes was a way that people referred to the carrier current networks at schools. Gigahertz is, of course, the super powerful frequency everyone wants to be on. It doesn't actually exist. A gigahertz it would be well beyond what we can hear on the dial, but there was always this aspiration at college radio to increase their signal. We have Lon Troyer, who was there at the throwback event, on the record in 1990 in a program guide saying, WCFM only 444 watts, but we feel like a million. So even if you were a small station, there always seemed to be an aspiration to grow bigger. And then grunge, of course, is what was being heard on air when my thesis comes to an end. So we're tracking three periods throughout radio history with WCFM's trajectory.
Well, Josh Picot, class of 24, thank you so much for being on a WCFM history interview.
Well, thanks for having me. Happy I could finally get my voice recorded and not corrupted this time. Hopefully these files save correctly. But yeah, thanks again for this.